from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Republicans and Democrats play big money politics these days. But lately, Republicans have been turning their big money guns on each other. Tea Party big money versus Main Street big money. It is hard to keep party unity when billionaires with big checkbooks part ways. This hour on Point, the big money squaring off in, running through the GOP's quote-unquote civil war. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you following the money? Koch brothers versus Crossroads versus Club for Growth versus defending Main Street. Is this a circular firing squad? Is it the ferment of evolution? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in a few minutes from big Republican commentator Raihan Salam. But joining me now from New York is Jim Rutenberg, national political reporter for the New York Times, co-author of the big piece over the weekend, Fiscal Crisis Sounds the Charge in GOP's Civil War. Jim Rutenberg, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Washington is Paul Blumenthal. He covers money and influence in politics for The Huffington Post. Paul Blumenthal, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Jim, we know there's more than money at work here. There are real political sentiments and real strands of thinking that are in conflict within the GOP and, of course, beyond. But money's at work. Describe, just before we go to the money and the groups and who's putting their chits where, you write over the weekend about this very public escalation of a very consequential battle for control of the GOP. What's going on? When Richard Viguerie tells you it's civil war in the GOP, he's a big conservative, what's he talking about?
Well, this has almost been decades in the making, but then again, it's almost like this is a real generational struggle. We as newspaper reporters love to be able to say that, and sometimes it's said when it's not true, but it is absolutely true right now. The Republicans have been for many years now heading to basically a tipping point where it's going to either be that the mainstream Republicans who have been running the party essentially since Nixon, you know, with Reagan being a major factor in the middle of this, but that they kind of came together with him, up against the real grassroots that has always felt like the leadership of their party has been too accommodating to Democrats and too wimpy when it comes to cutting government and spending.
And so this has just burst out like crazy right in the middle of the shutdown mess, Paul Blumenthal, when Republicans began talking very openly about this, very critically of one another over whether this was a good strategy or not, Paul.
Well, yeah, I mean, you saw a lot of talk about especially the campaign that pushed the government into a shutdown, which was this defund Obamacare campaign run by a network of outside conservative groups, these insurgent groups that have been really trying to push the Republican Party further to the right, you know, as Jim said, for decades, but escalating much more since the Great Recession in 2008. And, you know, you've seen sort of this backlash against, you know, what they've been doing in Congress from some of the more mainline Republicans, whether it's Senator Orrin Hatch or some of these outside business groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Now, maybe this would be easier to settle if there weren't big money in it, but there is big money in it. You quote Karl Rove in your piece, Jim Rutenberg, saying he's not sure that some of these new groups can persuade people, but they can certainly put up a lot of money to make their case, and they can go after moderate Republicans in primaries.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we've seen with any grassroots movement since really the Dean campaign starting in 2003 was that if you have passion on your side, you can raise a lot of small dollar donors before we get to the big money guys, right? Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, so Karl Rove is from the big money school of politics. That is what he excels at, is bringing together the chambers of commerce and the big oil billionaires, and people often like the Kochs. So so you have it's some smaller donors against some big guys, though the Tea Party has a couple deep pockets on its side as well.
I want to look at what's lining up where. I'm reading here, Paul, in the National Journal. Beth Reinhardt has a pretty good piece today where she's looking at the sort of mainstream Republicans who say they are now from Alabama to Alaska, center-right, business-oriented wing, gearing up to fight in the primaries and defend moderates. She quotes Steve LaTourette, former Republican congressman, more mainstream, out of Ohio, saying hope, you know, that they're going to take on those backing the Tea Party candidates. He says, hopefully we'll go into 8 to 10 races and beat the snot out of them with his group defending Main Street. This is Republican on Republican competition.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's been a mostly one-sided battle with groups on the conservative side, whether it's the Club for Growth or Freedom Works or these other Tea Party groups, basically having free rein in primaries. And I think that it's really an open question about whether these business groups or more moderate groups like La Tourette's Republican Main Street Partnership are really going to be able to have the money or the guts to get involved in these kind of races. I mean, if you look at Business Political Action Committee giving, they still give to these Tea Party members who voted to shut down the government, who voted to breach the debt limit. You know, they have other interests that align with these more conservative members, whether it's repealing Dodd-Frank or getting rid of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or, you know, blocking the implementation of Obamacare. I mean, and, you know, rolling back environmental regulations. You know, they have other interests that are equal to a fully functioning government.
Paul, walk us through, if you would, a little of the geography of this big money train in the GOP side. Of course, it's there on the Democrat side, too. Plenty of big money donors there. Though in the last presidential election campaign, I mean, that broke down differently when you just look at direct contributions. Barack Obama had 57% of what he raised under $200. Mitt Romney, 24% under $200. Mitt Romney, much more big on the contribution side. President Obama, much smaller, 11% to Romney's 39%. You get into super PAC donors, it's not so different. But on the GOP side, take us through this terrain. Club for Growth, the Koch brothers, Freedom Works, Crossroads. Who's lining up where, Paul? Give us the sort of picture.
Well, I mean, the main groups that we saw in this recent push towards the government shutdown were groups like the Club for Growth, which has been around since the 1990s, founded by hedge fund executives on Wall Street as a means to push the Republican Party further to the right and protect and keep low capital gains taxes and the carried interest rate, things like that. And then you have sort of these newer groups like Freedom Works, which split off from an old Koch brothers organization in the early 2000s. And these network of groups that are now sort of run or connected to former Senator Jim DeMint, who is now the president of the Heritage Foundation. And that's Senate Conservatives Fund and Heritage Action for America. And one of the interesting things about a lot of these groups is that they're sort of new and, you know, they're looking for newer sources of funding. So you look at Senate Conservatives Fund, which put up the Don't Fund Obamacare website. It got 2 million signatures for that, which if you signed it, it immediately took you to a donation page. And they raised record amounts in both August and September in moving up towards the shutdown. That was all from small donors, as Jim mentioned, that these groups are often looking for these kind of small donors. And then Freedom Works, which has had difficulty lately over a messy divorce between their former head, Dick Armey, and their current head, Matt Kibbe, you know, they are looking for more funding as well, as is Heritage Action, the, you know, political nonprofit of Jim DeMint's Heritage Foundation. And they recently held a big fundraiser on a golf course out in Oregon, headed, you know, Bandon Dunes, which is run by Michael Kaiser, who's a big Republican donor. And, you know, a lot of these groups raise money from corporations also, sometimes private companies more than the kind of publicly traded companies that would give to the Chamber of Commerce.
And what about individuals in this picture, in this topography? Where do the Koch brothers come down in the Republican Civil War? What about, I forget the name, but the guy who founded Cancer Centers for America? What about some of those?
We have Richard Stevenson, the CEO of Cancer Center for America. You know, he is on the board of Freedom Works. He's been a big donor in the past, and he helped sort of settle their problem with Dick Armey in 2012 by making a huge payout to both Freedom Works' super PAC and to Army to get him to step aside quietly. And, you know, you also have people like the Wyoming investor Foster Freeze, who donates to Freedom Works. You have people giving to the Club for Growth. Their biggest donor that is known in 2012 was the venture capitalist Peter Thiel, who has pretty much said that, you know, he doesn't really believe that democracy and freedom can coexist anymore. You also have hedge fund investors like Richard Mercer out of New York who give to the Club for Growth. And, you know, the Koch brothers, I think that, you know, Jim wrote about this in his piece, have sort of stayed out of the limelight of this Obamacare fight and the government shutdown as they sort of aim to focus more on blocking the expansion of Medicaid in the states. You know, they have a much longer-term strategy, and they don't really have to worry as much about a funding source there from their groups. I mean,
They are the funding source. In the Civil War, again, quote-unquote here in the GOP that Richard Viguerie is talking about, where do the Koch brothers come down? How are they looking at that, playing that, Jim?
I find them to be, and I bet Paul agrees with this, they're kind of fascinating right now because they have been such a driver, as the New Yorker first famously captured in this piece by Jane Mayer about how they fund everything from the ideological sort of libertarian driver of all of the Tea Party as much as some of the actually boots on the ground. And in this, they've kind of at times to me seemed to be talking out of both sides of their mouths, right? Because they've always tried to – they're as intense and they're very aggressive players in the political realm as we've seen. But they don't always want to be completely afoul of the business world. They have their own business interests, and I think they're somewhere betwixt and between here. So we've seen them at once kind of message, hey, we're not really for this shutdown tactic necessarily. They're not saying they're not, right? But we're not the ones advocating for this. Mm-hmm. But they also seem to be very much supporting those who are behind it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big money squaring off in, running through the GOP's civil war. Richard Viguerie, big-time conservative, calls it exactly that and says it's on inside the GOP. It's been mounting for a long time. Now it's there. Mainstream Republican, former Congressman Steve LaTourette says hopefully we'll beat the snot out of them. And he's talking about the Tea Party side of the party. There's big money in both parties these days. But right now, different views and different streams of money are giving fits to the GOP. Here's a bit of an ad. In Kentucky, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is up against a Tea Party primary challenge from first-time candidate Matt Bevin. Bevin is supported by the Senate Conservatives Fund, political action committee that supported the effort to defund Obamacare in Congress. Here's Matt Bevin's campaign ad saying McConnell, more mainstream, is part of the problem in Washington.
The new faces in Washington, like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, have fought to bring these issues to light. But our own Republican leadership has opposed them at every step. Now it seems that Mitch McConnell has cut and run from yet another fight. This government shutdown was completely avoidable if we had real leadership in Washington.
Matt Bevin challenging Mitch McConnell in that ad. Ads mean money, and the money is flowing in all kinds of ways, not just on screens. Americans for Prosperity, conservative advocacy group backed by the billionaire industrialist brothers Charles and David Koch, helped to bus demonstrators to demonstrations at state capitals across the country in the months leading up to the government shutdown. Here's Americans for Prosperity President Tim Phillips addressing a crowd of over 600 in Richmond, Virginia on August 19th. Bust in, folks.
Because we care, we're taking the time, and you're taking the time from family and work and community to come here to protect our fellow Virginians from his Obamacare. That's what it's about. We do care. That's why we're here. That's why you got on buses this morning. That's why you drove down this morning.
It's game on, battle on in the GOP. Jim Rutenberg is with us from the New York Times, national political reporter there. Paul Blumenthal from Huffington Post joins us from Washington. I want to welcome Raihan Salaam into our conversation, columnist for Reuters, lead writer of the Agenda blog at National Review, big conservative Republican commentator, senior fellow at the R Street Institute. Raihan Salaam, it's great to have you, co-author with Ross Douthat of the Grand New Party. Raihan, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
What's going on with this struggle in the GOP? How does money fit into it, Raihan?
Well, I think the larger issue is that the political parties have grown much weaker than they have been traditionally. I don't generally think that more money, more spending is necessarily a problem in itself. The concern, however, is that while spending through the political parties is more accountable, spending through independent groups is much less so. The lines of responsibility are blurred. And so I think that the fact that successive rounds of campaign finance regulation have weakened the parties is a real problem, and it's led to much of the polarization. It's led to a lot of the policy failures that we've seen in recent years.
So, I mean, today, if you're a player, a candidate or a politician, you've got to have super PACs somewhere behind you.
Yeah, I think that's right, because when you think about a political party, one of their greatest strengths traditionally was that they were allowed to engage in a great deal of coordinated spending with their candidates. Now, however, political parties are treated very much akin to other independent groups. There are strict limits on the amount of coordinated spending they can engage in. And as a result, if I'm a candidate, a Democrat or a Republican candidate, I'm not really relying on the political party. I'm relying on my own fundraising network or on a wide variety of outside groups. And so the party can't really impose any discipline on me. And the party's interest is in building a broad coalition that can appeal to voters across the country. Whereas if I'm dealing with this narrower situation in which I have my own fundraising network or I have outside groups that I'm accountable to rather than to a national political party, then you get a situation in which what suits the interests of an individual member seeking to raise money, raise ideological money, let's say, could be very much in tension with the interests of the national party.
So the party's role is to lead or to reconcile or try to reconcile these different perspectives, some of them really turbocharged by big bucks?
I think that ideally what the political party would do to form this kind of broad coalition is reconcile lots of differences. So, you know, it could be that conservatives in Utah, conservatives in, you know, rural areas, they might have one point of view, but a political party that's reconciling these interests would recognize that, hey, wait a second, we also need to represent, say, suburban voters in coastal parts of the country. And so you don't want to move too far in one direction or another in order to have the broadest possible coalition. But again, if you're an individual candidate who doesn't depend on the national political party that aims to reconcile those interests, then, you know, you're going to be pushing in one direction rather than the other. And that, by the way, could be in a leftward direction or a rightward direction.
Sure.
It's going to be away from the interests of the party as a whole.
You've said in the GOP right now, it's a free-for-all. You've got elements working clearly at cross-purposes.
Yeah, I think that's right because, you know, again, a political party that is allowed to coordinate, that party has a long-term interest as well as a short-term interest. So, you know, in a sense, it's like having, you know, someone with this broader synoptic perspective rather than the kind of free-for-all that we see at work right now. And I think that that's a big, big problem, not just for Republicans, for Democrats as well.
Sure.
But right now you're seeing it much more on the Republican side.
And what about the impact on individual lawmakers of having to go after that big money, the super PACs and all the rest? What kind of lawmaker does it produce?
Well, this is an interesting conceptual question. So if you have the parties raising more money, it has all kinds of changes on the political system and the experience of an individual lawmaker. So right now, as you'll hear endlessly from members of Congress, they have to spend an enormous amount of their time, some would say a majority of their time, raising money rather than meeting with their colleagues, working on policy development, constituent servants, and much else. Whereas if you had parties, if you were able to outsource much of the work of fundraising to political parties, you'd actually have a different kind of candidate. You would have the kind of candidates who, you know, don't necessarily have their own networks of wealthy people and what have you. You could have impecunious, you know, candidates, people who have spent their time building some expertise rather than, you know, cultivating a fundraising network. So first of all, you would get different kinds of personnel. You would also get much more competitive elections because incumbents, as a general rule, like a system that is candidate-centered because, you know, of course, incumbents have higher name recognition. It's a lot easier for them to raise money than, say, a talented challenger in a no-hope district, whereas that challenger is someone a party could back, you know, in a way that could benefit them without having to build that fundraising network.
Ryan Salam, Paul Blumenthal, Jim Rutenberg, stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in from Albany, New York. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I'm concerned about the irresponsibility and the recklessness of the business leaders that fund this stuff. You know, you talked about them playing both sides of the equation here with the radical groups and the mainstream groups, but they also fund the think tanks that create the policy papers and the slanted talking points that allows all the small money to be raised. Yeah, have they created a Frankenstein monster they can't control? Are they surprised that folks have taken it this far, that the public is scared about crashing the economy and the government and not functioning anymore?
Ryan Salam, what do you say to that, you know, have they created a monster situation suggestion?
Well, I think that when you're thinking about business leaders, keep in mind that they're navigating the same highly complicated, highly confusing landscape everyone else is navigating. And these guys are as surprised by some of the outcomes, you know, as any average reader as well.
In a way, so, you have to make a distinction these days between quote-unquote business leaders, which sounds almost like the more moderate, if you will, Chamber of Commerce group versus business leaders versus billionaires, individuals, Ryan.
Right. There's tremendous heterogeneity. You have, you know, again, you have some business leaders who are very ideologically motivated. You have others who are interested in the well-being of their particular businesses. And, you know, and it's funny because there's one way of looking at it, which says that the ideological ones are the good guys because they're not necessarily saying, I'm intervening in politics in the interest of my bottom line.
Yep.
I have some vision of society. So, you know, there are no obvious good guys or bad guys in this situation. And I'd say that, you know, the problem isn't having a variety of voices. The problem isn't having a variety of different think tanks, for example. The big problem is that the political parties don't have the ability to engage in real policy development, and they don't have the ability to discipline their members to stick to a shared script. And I think that that's a problem for our democracy because it actually makes it hard for voters to figure out what they're getting when they're voting for one candidate or another.
Let's listen to Karl Rove for just a second. Of course, he had a lot to do with rallying conservatives, putting big organizations together, putting some considerable money together. Super PAC, American Crossroads, co-founded by Karl Rove. Now he's started an initiative called the Conservative Victory Project to defeat Republican challengers whose primary victories could lead to seats falling to Democrats. In effect, to go after Tea Party challengers if he thinks they are going to lead to a loss where there might be a win. Here he was in August. This is before the shutdown, but he was on with Fox News host Sean Hannity's radio show. And Rove talking about Senator Mike Lee of Utah, telling him his tactics in battling Obamacare could work against the goals of the broader GOP. Here's Karl Rove.
I applaud Senator Lee for fighting. I think we all need to fight, but I think we have better strategies available for us, and we particularly need to be in a position where we're focused more on the opposition than on castigating ourselves, and more, it strikes me, on effectively undermining Obamacare rather than trying to sort of set a standard that says if you don't agree with me, you know, you're not sufficiently conservative.
Karl Rove there talking about Utah's Mike Lee, who was right at the heart of the whole shutdown push. Jim Rutenberg, you and your colleagues have been out talking with lots of Republicans here. Do Karl Rove and others think that, you know, looking back, they have in some way have created a bit of a monster here, as our caller asks?
You know, it's funny because Jon Stewart of The Daily Show did an interesting take on that and basically implied they had created this monster and had no right to complain. I think the interesting thing about Rove and almost the genius of Rove back in the Bush era was he was able to – he was that dictator we're talking about in a way. Like he kept – he found a way to wrangle the energy and anger of the grassroots and get the big money from the big business, and he kept them all under this tent mm-hmm. of Bush Republicanism. But he was basically – keeping down some of this discontent, and he and the Bush campaign, the Bush campaigns, and the Republican Party were able to hold it all together. And really, what we're seeing now has its roots in the end of that. When Rove starts being vilified for the spending, for the compassionate conservatism, which many of these Republicans in the grassroots now say it was just, you know, horrible big government anti-Republican sort of policies or kind of anti their philosophy. So. Rove is a really interesting figure in this. So I would say he would argue he did not create this. He used it for his purposes and his candidates' purposes, and they got a lot done in the process. So he's a fascinating figure. But when people talked about the genius of Rove, it was this very thing we're talking about, holding all these factions together.
Paul, when Karl Rove is starting his victory project here and you've got this defending Main Street, has this gone now materially from a kind of ideological conversation, a fight over ideas or strategy to a real sort of a fisticuffs political fight in the campaigns upcoming?
I mean, we haven't seen that come out yet, and the Conservative Victory Project hasn't really raised any money that they've reported yet. Of course, that they can tap into Karl Rove's well of millionaires at any moment. I mean, they can raise $10 million from Sheldon Adelson at the drop of a hat, or from any of the Texas multimillionaires or billionaires who have funded Karl Rove and George W. Bush's campaigns in the past. But, you know, again, at the moment, we really haven't seen anything aside from words from Karl Rove, from the Chamber of Commerce, from business leaders. And, you know, they still continue to give campaign contributions to the people that they say are hurting the Republican Party.
Reihan, Steve LaTourette says we're going to beat the snot out of them. And he's talking about fellow Republicans in the Tea Party. Do you think they're going to step up in material ways and have this fight post the shutdown situation?
I think they're going to attempt to have such a fight. But I think the fundamental problem is that the number of voters who engage in the primary process, the number of voters is quite small. And so it doesn't necessarily take tremendous resources to mobilize a coalition of highly ideological voters in the primary process.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're thinking about Karl Rove and his efforts, the thing to keep in mind is that the presidency is the focal point of our system. So, for example, Democrats seem a lot more united now than Republicans. And part of that is because there's a loyalty to a president who can serve as a kind of unifying figure. And Karl Rove benefited from the informal power that flows from that. But the thing that happened after the financial crisis, after the Iraq War, is that there's been a general collapse in faith in political elites. If a Democrat isn't the next president, I think you might see a similar kind of energy, a similar tension from the grassroots on the Democratic side as well. So once that informal power is gone, you don't really have a strong formal party apparatus that can, for example, intervene in primaries and say, wait a second, this candidate is the more viable candidate. Karl Rove is trying to do what a strong party would naturally do. And the fact is that he's just not able to do it.
Let's go to Sherry calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Sherry. Thank you very much for calling. You are on the air.
Thanks. I think that instead of looking at this as just a civil war within one party or looking at factions, if we keep in mind the whole country, that everybody, regardless of whether they've ever identified as one corner of one party or not,
mm-hmm.
We actually all want to get things done. Each faction wants to get things done. And factions in all different parties and unidentified, we want to get things done together. And we can't. If we focus less factionally and more on consensus, then I think we all come out ahead.
Listen, I follow you all the way there until you say together, because some of these factions, even today within the GOP, seem to have quite opposed goals for what they want to get done, Sherry.
Well, what's an example of that?
Well, you can either, if you're supporting Obamacare or you're looking to defund it, you talk about getting things done together, you can't do that together.
Well, right, but everybody actually wants health care. Maybe we disagree over Obamacare, mm-hmm. but we could find a great way to do health care, stepping away from this thing called Obamacare. And, you know, and I speak kind of from a progressive end of, you know, old-fashioned labels.
Sherry, our time is short before the break. Jim Rutenberg, there's something large that I'm sympathetic there to, except when I look at the realities of what's going on politically, a lot of this money, let's say, is not interested in that kind of compromise.
Well, if you look at the new Senate candidate in Mississippi who's going to run up against Ted Cochran, Chris McDaniel, his opening speech the day after the shutdown ended was that compromise is not something I'm going to do, that I have 17 trillion reasons not to compromise. So you do have some people running on a platform of absolutely not working together.
Wow. And there we are. I mean, Paul, here's Nina S. online. And whose cash is fueling the Democrats? Probably all the same. Don't be naive. Do we have a comparable polarization in the Democratic Party, Paul?
I don't really see anything comparable in the, the polarization within the Democratic Party. The Democrats went through something similar in this under George W. Bush. But, you know, progressive leaders have basically said that, you know, they were looking at data and demographic trends and that, you know, what they were pushing was more progressive policies, and that's what the American people wanted. So, you know, to them, they see this in the Republican Party as just a fight over ideology and not over actually winning seats in government.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big money squaring off these days in running through the GOP's civil war, as one big conservative there has called it. Rayhan Salam is with us, Republican commentator, lead writer of the Agenda blog at National Review, senior fellow at the R Street Institute. Jim Rutenberg is here, national political correspondent for the New York Times. Paul Blumenthal is with us, covers money and influence in politics for the Huffington Post. Lots of commentary here. Chris says, megalomaniacs trying to paint themselves into history. Well, maybe. Adam says, as long as a few very wealthy people continue to find extremists to back, the stalemate will continue. Here's a listener who asks, and let me put this one to you, Rayhan, asks, so if we're seeing more freelancers, I guess big money freelancers, why are parties allowing these people to associate with the party? If the parties don't like the extremes, why do they support them anyway? some presumptions about who's controlling whom in there that I'm not sure you would roll with, Raihan. But you get the gist of that, the sort of tension now between big money and party agendas. And, you know, why do parties go along with it? Do they have a choice, Raihan?
Well, fundamentally, the parties as such don't have a choice. So one thing to keep in mind is look at the 2012 election. You had a huge infusion of money from independent expenditure groups. Yet what was the net effect of that money? This is a question that's very difficult to answer, but one thing that seems to have happened is that independent expenditure groups were essentially bidding up the cost of television advertisements.
Yeah.
That is, rather than actually having some broad effect in moving the electorate in one direction or another, they just seem to represent a huge amount of noise. And you actually saw candidates distancing themselves in some ways from these ads, you know, again, because they weren't accountable for those ads. So my view is that if you had a campaign finance reform that strengthened the relative position of parties, allowed them to engage in more coordinated spending, you would see a natural tendency in which money would flow from unaccountable independent expenditure groups towards accountable party organizations, just because that spending is a lot more efficient. And actually, the candidates can actually use that money to much greater effect. So I think that that's actually one thing you see happen from at least some big donors. They're seeing that, well, wait a second, it doesn't look as though this independent expenditure money is getting us to the goals that we want. Now, when you look at the Senate Conservatives Fund and groups like that, you know, that's a somewhat different story because their goal is actually more internal to the party in some cases rather than in terms of winning elections.
Jim Rutenberg, I guess I get that. On the other hand, it's not hard at all to find Republicans who say, look, you had casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson. He came in, put a lot of money behind Newt Gingrich, maybe forced Mitt Romney into more conservative posture than he would naturally have gone to. And I've seen this calculus laid out. Therefore, ended up losing, Jim.
Yeah, definitely. to me, that was one of the most fascinating storylines of the 2012 primaries was exactly that. Gingrich would have been nowhere without Sheldon Adelson propping him up. Similarly, you could argue that Rick Santorum, who helped push Romney further to the right as well, wouldn't have been there without Foster Freese, the billionaire or almost billionaire we were speaking about earlier. But I do want to make one point in all of this.
Yes.
So in presidential politics, it certainly works out that way. Absolutely. What we did see in 2010 and to some extent in 2012 was that the establishment money was initially caught off guard. But when they did play, they had a hard time beating back these primary challenges, even if they outspent the Tea Party candidates by and what Matt Kibbe of FreedomWorks called an order of magnitudes, because the passion is with the grassroots. Mm-hmm. So the establishment did not want Rand Paul to win in Kentucky, and so but they had no say in that. They got trounced. So how far their money can go, they have a higher bar. In a way, it's easier for them to cough up huge dollars because they have these huge donors. But the Tea Party candidates, when they have the energy, the bar is lower for them in terms of how much money. They don't need to match the establishment dollar for dollar when they have the energy.
And especially, of course, in the House, where those districts are smaller and the way they've been redrawn, partly on the back of earlier considerable money efforts, make some fortresses there. Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm well. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The point that I want to make is that I think the fiscally conservative wing of the Republican Party, which is represented by Tea Party and some libertarian elements, is going to beat out the socially conservative wing through the grassroots. And all these big money people aren't really going to make that much of a difference on that. And the key driver here will be Obamacare, that the young people aren't going to want to pay for this. And the rollout of Obamacare was so atrocious with such a crappy website. If it was an IPO, the stock would be a penny stock right now. So you're going to have all these young people backing away from Obamacare, and people are going to long forget about the government shutdown, be looking at this disastrous rollout that really should be scrapped and started over.
I mean, well, we will see how that rolls out. I mean, clearly the rollout has had big problems. On the other hand, the GOP in the shutdown period, at least, had some terrible numbers that came out. Paul Blumenthal, do you think that people just forget about that and, you know, they're on down the road and Alan says, hey, young people aren't going to want to get into this and so the GOP's fine?
I mean, I think that that ignores a lot of polling that's been done around both, you know, young people and the Obamacare law, which, you know, has become more popular since its rollout, mostly due to partisan solidification, more Democrats saying that they support it than used to. And if you look at, you know, polls about young people, people under 30 years old, you know, they generally identify as progressive or liberal. You know, one poll from Pew has shown that they favor socialism over capitalism. So, you know, to say that they're going to reject this law because of a website rollout, you know, other big social programs have had tough rollouts, whether it was Medicare Part D, Medicare itself, or Social Security. You know, I think that, you know, if they can get the website fixed within a general amount of time, that most of that will be forgotten. Will the government shutdown be forgotten? Probably not to a degree, but, you know, if you look at how House districts are gerrymandered and, you know, the kind of wave that Democrats would need to actually win back the House or even protect the Senate, you know, that's a whole other story about whether the government shutdown will affect that.
Yeah, time will tell on both those fronts. Alan, we hear your interpretation. You've got numbers out there that might suggest something else, but we'll see. Bill in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Bill, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love this discussion. My comment and question is, it seems like this is a repeating pattern in politics, as same as our lives. It's like a few really vocal, chest-pounding radicals take over. I mean, I've seen the same thing in parent Little League meetings, a church meeting, somebody with some radical idea, and they're very vocal. And they take over the discussion, and we moderates just kind of sit there and think, oh, this is nuts, you know, and wait. We have to wait till the moderates finally say, enough. You know, I think probably Nancy Pelosi hurt the Democratic Party when she was Speaker of the House. I mean, her ideology for the congressional group that she represents, I don't think there's four other districts in the United States that have the same ideology as San Francisco.
And Bill, I appreciate your call. Let me put it to Rayhan Salam. Certainly Democrats went through their version of this. Bill Clinton with his third way, kind of moderate movement that had a lot of more progressive liberal Democrats unhappy. Now Republicans with their own. But what about, Rayhan, our caller Bill in Stillwater, Oklahoma's presumption that eventually moderates say enough and that is the last word here? I mean, you've got a big party, Tea Party, within the GOP that's not looking to go that way. Do you presume that moderates will win out in the end, Rayhan?
I don't. My basic view is that when you look at the culture as a whole, it's not just Republicans or Democrats. There's been a larger loss of faith in institutions. There's been a larger loss of faith in elites. And I think that what's really surprising is that we haven't seen more manifestations of this in our politics yet. And my guess is that we're actually going to see more manifestations of it in the future. So, for example, in 2008, people forget how big a shock it was that Barack Obama defeated Hillary Clinton. That was the first sign of a deep discontent with someone who is considered to be the heir apparent. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at the Tea Party movement on a smaller scale, this represents a rejection of Karl Rove and the Bush legacy, and that's still working itself out. We don't know what the new synthesis is going to be. And similarly, you know, if you look to a Democratic primary in 2016, you know, many people are already saying that, you know, Elizabeth Warren will be the Bill de Blasio of the country, Bill de Blasio being the left-leaning candidate for mayor in New York City, mm-hmm. that there's some energy on that side because of a loss of faith in the leadership class, whether the leadership class is on the left or the right or in the center. So I think that actually we're going to see more of these paroxysms. We're going to see more of this kind of intense conflict. And the synthesis that's eventually going to emerge, I couldn't tell you exactly what it's going to look like, but it's not going to look like moderation circa 1995 or 2005 or 1985. It's going to be a new synthesis that's going to try to reconcile these different ideological tendencies.
Jim Rutenberg, Rayhan may be exactly right, but I mean paroxysms of conflict, my gosh. I guess one question that the money in here raises is, how does the country know when it's in the middle of an authentic conversation with itself about where the country should go? And these days, with billionaires playing all over the place, you know, when it's a ginned-up conversation, when it's somebody's personal, you know, personal obsession that's driving the ads and the sort of drumbeat, Jim?
Well, I think when you talk about the country as a whole, I do think that people are savvier than they often get credit for, and they have strong opinions, and they're not always going to be swayed by money and ads. Though, again, you'd rather have all the money and ads on your side than not. But so you look at some of the polling. I mean, which we haven't really gone that deeply into. the polling for the Tea Party is abysmal right now, and the polling for the Republican Party, it's abysmal right now. These polls mean nothing by the time of presidential, or potentially mean nothing by the time of presidential year turns around or even by the time the midterms start. And I do think there's one figure here that we haven't mentioned that much either, and that's Rand Paul, who is trying. At times, he's very much aligned with the Tea Party. He supported the shutdown, thought that it was a winning strategy, as he was famously picked up saying to the minority leader Mitch McConnell on TV. But Rand Paul tries to kind of bring together these left and right disaffected strands. So he has some appeal to the Occupy movement as much as he has appeal to the Tea Party movement. So there could be – I don't know if he's the figure, but there could be some figure that picks up on the anti-institutional sort of outsider groups and bring them together into some kind of movement.
Let's get a caller from Rand Paul country here. Somerset, Kentucky, James is calling. Hi, James. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My comment is, would you not say that the Tea Party movement, you could look at it as kind of a continuation of a party realignment that's been happening with the Republicans as early as 2004, where there was the huge push to push the moderates, what they called rhinos, mm-hmm. out of the party, and now we've just seen it shift in kind of a different direction from the more social ideological to the Tea Party.
The natural evolution of the GOP going on with the Tea Party. What do you say, Rayhan?
I think that makes sense. I mean, there certainly has been an increasing ideological coherence of both political parties. But I think that the definition of what the Tea Party movement is has really changed a lot over time. For example, there are some people who characterize it as a movement of fiscal conservatives and libertarians. Yet people who identify with the Tea Party movement tend to actually be more socially conservative than others. Many Tea Party voters tend to be older. And so they tend to be very skeptical about, for example, measures to reduce the cost of Medicare over time. So what I think we see happening is this period of instability in which political entrepreneurs arise and arise and arise and then say, well, wait a second. We don't just oppose Obamacare. Now the only legitimate conservative position is a tactical position on defunding Obamacare, and that suddenly becomes the new conservative position. And then you could have another political entrepreneur saying that something else is the sine qua non of being a conservative. So I think that it's that lack of coordination, that fact that you keep having this entrepreneurial emergence of new litmus tests, that's part of why this is such a confusing moment for Republicans and part of why I think Republicans would profit from a stronger party that can really hash these things out.
Is there any group that the party doesn't seem to be able to do it. Is there some subgroup that could make that truce, make that peace within the GOP? We read, Jim Rutenberg, in your piece, we read about this I don't know much about this group, but this Council for National Policy that was meeting in New Orleans last weekend, I guess, some kind of umbrella organization of conservative activists. Who is that, Jim? And do they have the power within the Republican realm to coordinate, simmer this down or not?
Well, I think they – in that passage of the story, what we are talking about more is these are, again, very conservative – a grouping of very conservative groups, very secret – very kind of secrecy-oriented collection of activists. And in that case, what they were looking at was Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and is he really someone you go after? Do you kind of try to storm the castle and lose? So that shows some of the pragmatism coming into play for some of these groups get together. And
what
really
did they decide? Do you know, in their meeting in New Orleans?
As of the weekend, they were iffy about it. They didn't know if they wanted to go down that road. And interestingly enough, Bevin, the gentleman,
Contender,
Matt
challenger.
Bevin, who's going to challenge McConnell, there's some skepticism about him even within the Tea Party movement. So, indeed, the Tea Party is hard to pin down, and it doesn't always work as a monolith.
I mean, Rayhan, the word was out of the shutdown uproar that the GOP's kind of has to pull together here. Or maybe that's not it. But when you've got all these groups, Senate Conservatives Fund, the Madison Project, Club for Growth, Heritage Action, Freedom Works, Karl Rove's group, American Crossroads, can anybody coordinate this, Rayhan? When it's so, all these have their funding, all these have their bases. Can anybody pull it together?
Well, I think the way this really tends to happen is that you have a presidential nominee emerge. So in the period before Barack Obama came on the scene, you had Cindy Sheehan, you had a tremendous amount of energy on the Netroots left, this anti-war energy that was targeting people like Hillary Clinton who were seen as establishment figures. So I think one scenario is that you just have a relatively popular Republican presidential nominee emerge who then informally winds up reconciling these things and leading various groups to temper some of their opposition. Another possibility, however, is that we're in a moment in which that's just no longer possible. That remains to be seen, but I still think that's the kind of most likely scenario for how you eventually see some reconciliation.
Who's the most likely person to be able to do that or imagined as able?
That's an extremely difficult question to answer. I think that the model will be someone who is seen as a conservative, and because this person is seen as a reliable conservative, that person is then able to pivot to the center. Ronald Reagan was someone who could move to the center, who could generate all kinds of opposition, yet he was seen as authentically conservative and connected to conservative values, so he was allowed to make those pivots. Someone who is not seen as authentic in that way doesn't have that same wherewithal.
Ronald Reagan raises Paul Blumenthal just a few seconds here, but back in the 70s, Republicans had a big Donnybrook, and they came out of it Reagan strong. Do you see that emerging from this period of civil war, as Vigory has it?
I mean, anything is possible for the Republicans on this, but, you know, politics are just completely different than they were in the 1970s when you had much stronger union strength. And, you know, the issues that people were paying attention to and that helped elect Ronald Reagan are just dramatically different then than they are now.
Well, what a big picture with money all over. Paul Blumenthal with Huffington Post, Jim Rutenberg with The New York Times, Raihan Salam writes The Agenda and National Review and much more. Great to have all of you. Thanks so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.